Once thought to be lost to the wolves that live in the mysterious wood, Lazarus has decided it's time. Time to show himself, to make his move to claim the throne of Leary. Beside him, Agnes, a woman sworn to protect him by any means necessary. How far will she go, though? I'm Heather Songster, and this is Hopelessly Romantic. Welcome back, readers and romance seekers, to another episode. Today, we return not only to Harlequin, but to a novel that I had to shelve because, frankly, it had confounded me on my first attempt to read it. Yes, today we are looking at A Bride for the Lost King by Maisie Yates, sequel to His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation from episode 12. In some ways, I was glad that I allowed myself to read the first book. Like I said, A Bride for the Lost King was basically incomprehensible without the context of the first novel. In hindsight, however, I regret that these books ever crossed my path, and I regret my promise to return to the series at all. I'll give us a short tour of the Kingdom of Leary before we get started, though, lest I get too far ahead of myself. Leary is, of course, a fictional kingdom somewhere in Europe. Right next to the castle where the king makes his home is this massive forest, supposedly filled with wolves, and more than a few people have lost their lives to said wolves. Lazarus, a prince of the royal family, was one such casualty. Until, however, he decided to appear in front of his brother Alexius, basically to scold Alexius for being a garbage boyfriend, and to bring his lady love home, this being Tinley from the last book. According to Lazarus, there are a ton of people in the wood, enough for their own small micronation even, an impressive claim. Something that I really need to make clear is the way the narration builds up our setting. By that, I mean poorly. The narrative vernacular, the dialogue, the way characters behave, none of it matches up with a modern setting complete with Wi-Fi and Pop-Tarts. Everything reads like it was supposed to take place in a more rustic concept, right up until the main characters hop on a private jet to France. Usually I tried to give the author the benefit of the doubt when I pick these books up. If I had read His Majesty's Forbidden Temptation first before I picked up A Bride for the Lost King, I would have hoped that the author had adjusted the narrative style in order to better mesh with the setting. However, considering that I had already attempted the first four pages of the sequel beforehand, that hope never even attempted to make itself known. I'll also remind us that I didn't much care for Alex in the previous novel. From his first introduction to his repeated whinging about being the Lion of the Dark Wood, I was not impressed, and I am still of the opinion that Tinley could have done much better if she hadn't been under the pressure of needing to get married if she wanted any part of her inheritance. If you want the full story, I'd recommend you pop on over to episode 12 to acquaint yourself with the Kingdom of Leary and its emo King Alex. For the rest of you, please, join me in an exercise in patience. As our story today comes from Harlequin Presents, it has the imprint's usual style. The top half of the cover is devoted solely to the title and the author, while the bottom half gives us an illustration. And all I can think of when I look at this cover is lazy. The left side has our couple, a man in a blue suit and a woman in a red dress. They look like they are about to kiss, but the Photoshop hack job suggests otherwise. It's clearly evident that the models were pulled from two different sources, and they've just been plastered in front of a forested hilltop with a generic castle right there at the top. I don't think there's really anything originally authentic about our couple either. Every little detail looks like it's been mucked with some way or another, down to the man's hair and gaudy watch on his wrist. It honestly looks like it was slapped together in 5 minutes, and I am all the worse for having to look at it. Alright, so let's get into the meat of this thing. We begin with Agnes, asking Lazarus what sword she should take with her when they go to meet with King Alexius. We are given a glimpse at this little micronation, where it looks like a village from another time, but with hidden modern conveniences, like, apparently, fiber-optic internet. Even this detail infuriates me. This supposed secret kingdom has freaking high-speed internet, but from where? Fiber-optic internet just doesn't spawn into the ground waiting for someone to connect to it, like tapping into an ore vein. That crap costs money. It requires time and construction and money, and those are three things that you don't exactly have on hand when you are trying to keep the other giant, potentially hostile kingdom from knowing you exist. And money is another thing. So, Lazarus has apparently been running around all of Europe, taking his people's assets and effectively multiplying them beyond any reasonable degree. First, he is supposed to be dead, so who the hell knows how he's been doing any kind of legitimate business. My guess is he's YOLO'd his entire nation's net worth into GME and has made off before anyone noticed. Secondly, the fact that we haven't even started and I am already ranting about this is not a good sign. Anyway, Lazarus has apparently been biding his time in the forest, waiting, plotting revenge against his family. He had been taken in by the previous leader of these hidden people, a fellow named Agamemnon, when wolves had tried to tear him apart as a little boy. He learned from Agamemnon that the true rulers of the land were supposed to be the people of the trees, and as such, Lazarus swore to restore the people to their rightful place. All right, I will get it out of the way. We have Lazarus, who has basically returned from the dead in the last novel. Lazarus had a brother named Dionysus, who was infamous for his love of drink and women. So I will just direct you to the name Agamemnon and allow you to make your own conclusions. I don't know what this author is like, but I doubt subtlety is among her strong suits. So now that he had made himself known to Alexius and to the kingdom as a whole, Lazarus is ready to make his move. He tells Agnes that she will not be armed, and while she loved hearing his voice, she was not happy to receive this particular command. Here, we can see Lazarus through her eyes. Lazarus was tall, over 6'5", with the sculpted face of an avenging angel, at least in part. It was his scars, deep, lashing and cruel, covering half of that face, that gave him the matter of devil. Dark eyes, hard as obsidian, and a mouth that turned over into cruel with the slightest curve. He was not a man who looked as if he needed protection. But in her world, in their world, in the wood, when a person was saved from death, they swore fealty to their savior, as she had done to Lazarus when she was just 16, and in the 8 years since. Oh look, another heroine who is somehow in no position to say no when the love interest in question demands anything from them. And that's super handy for Lazarus, isn't it? He doesn't want to make open war at first. He wants to first visit Alexius so they can begin the task of pretending to reconcile. Either Alexius can step down from there and then give the crown to Lazarus, or else they will be making war. So instead of bringing Agnes on along as muscle, Lazarus intends to use her as an ornament, posing as his fiancée in order to, quote, disarm Alexius, making Lazarus seem softer. He's not shy about talking down to her either. She asks why he never discussed this plan with her, and he says, "My plans are not for you to know, little one, and I hate everything." If Alexius treated Tindley like a child in the last novel, Lazarus is worse. If he gives Agnes any compliment, it's tied to the fact that he's the reason she's any good. If she disagrees with him, he acts as though she is too stupid to see why he's right. And to peek into her backstory, she was the daughter of a con man who fled from America with her to Europe, a fact that he uses to remind her of her place. "This is not a con, Agnes. There is no negotiation to be made, no side alleys that one can take." Her cheeks stung with heat and shame. "I did not mean it in that way," she said. Her father had been a con artist. She was not. "I am made from the mold that you forged me in," she said, tilting her chin up. "And I do wish that you would allow me to bring a sword." This snippet of dialogue is a good example of one of my sources of frustration. No one talks like this. I don't know why we have to stretch out words that could be contractions, or why we've forced formality that doesn't feel authentic. I realize that given the setting of our novel, our characters may not be speaking English exactly, but it's written by an American author for an American audience. There are ways to invoke that otherworldly fairy tale feeling that I think the author is going for, but here it's handled clumsily, and instead of being enchanted, I am annoyed. Agnes resigns herself to the fact that Lazarus will be calling all of the shots, and he sticks her on a private plane to Paris so that she can be appropriately outfitted for her role as his fiancé. And I have no idea why we needed to go there, but for some reason Agnes insists on sitting on the floor of the aircraft until Lazarus scolds her for it. I don't know why. Is it to make Agnes look wild or untamed? I have no idea. From the plane, they get into a private car, which then takes them to an expensive department store, in which they are taken to an exclusive dressing room, where apparently they were expected. A woman comes out, speaking French, I assume, and Lazarus responds in Lyrian, assuming the woman would, quote, figure it out. I hate this guy. The woman takes Agnes back behind a curtain and promptly freaks out when she discovers Agnes is packing a knife. She calls Agnes a creature, and I hate her too. And I hate that Agnes had to fall victim to the femme fatale trope of concealing weapons anywhere she could manage. While she is made up and dressed up like a doll, we get... She looked in the mirror, glad to be shielded from Lazarus's all-too-keen gaze. She didn't recognize the woman she saw standing there, who looked surprisingly thin and shapely all at once, and whose body seemed to be firmly entrenched in this world, while her hair remained wild and part of another place and time, and then suddenly the curtains parted and he was there. We're getting a theme of duality here, and unfortunately Agnes's figure is victim to the metaphor. Lazarus tells her to show off the outfits, and she bites back that she is not a fashion model. He agrees, saying that he doesn't really care about fashion, just that she's able to pull off the part of his fiancé. After seeing her in a variety of styles, he orders that they will take them all. Agnes, frustrated at being used like this, suggests that maybe she didn't like any of them. He tells her that her opinion doesn't matter, only his. You know, I don't say this very often when it comes to these books, if at all, but fuck this guy. I thought Alexius was bad. I had no idea, not a hint, that he would be outdone by Lazarus. This is the guy who looked at Alexius and Tinley in those woods and apparently had the emotional intelligence to say, I've changed my mind about maybe revenge, go get your lady. This is the guy? After the shopping trip, they go to an apartment that I guess Lazarus had settled up ahead of time. Once inside, Agnes is whisked away to the bathroom by attendants where she is scrubbed and cleaned, her hair cut and dried, her face painted, as she calls it. They stuff her into an outfit that did not come from their shopping trip, and her only consolation is that she was able to hide weapons underneath it. If we are going for a Cinderella story, where this girl had grown up in poverty and suddenly gets to be pampered, if you can call it that, in Paris, I would prefer it if she actually had any enjoyment out of the experience. Now that she is all dolled up, they are off to a restaurant, which is described as the sort of place where one would go to avoid paparazzi, so, of course, it was covered with paparazzi, naturally. On the way there, Lazarus is getting a good look at Agnes, surprised that he found her beautiful, which is impossible, since he had rescued the creature years ago off the streets. Yep, his words. We are privy to some backstory about why Lazarus is on this quest of revenge. Apparently the people of the wood were sidelined by something his great-grandfather did. I don't know what it was, but at this point, I don't really care. He remembers how Agamemnon saved him from some wolves, and that old fellow insisted the big dogs he had trained were nothing like those wolves in the forest, despite how much they scared poor little Lazarus. Uh-huh. Back in the present day, Lazarus is thinking about his relationship to Agnes, how she's his ward in a way, how they are connected to each other. Holmeslice can spin it any way he wants, but he is thinking on the nature of his ownership over Agnes. Once in the restaurant, he guesses correctly that she's packing, And he chastises her again. But, dude, I have no idea what you were thinking. She is essentially your bodyguard. She's been your bodyguard for years. And when you tell your bodyguard to pretend to be your fiancé and to not be the thing she spent years doing, what did you expect to happen? From both of their perspectives, it's clear that Agnes has not been viewed as a woman, just as a warrior, and it's not fair to her that suddenly he wants the warrior to become the woman overnight. And he keeps thinking to himself, it's so good that I found her. Her life would suck if it wasn't for me. I didn't even make her sleep on rocks the way Agamemnon made me sleep on rocks. Like, any worth she has is only attached via her relationship to him. He is what makes her special. Not her devotion to him, her willingness to lay down her life to him, her loyalty. Nope, she is only these things because he was just so nice to her. And now he has the gall to be annoyed when she is nervous walking out and about without her regular means of protection on her. To his credit, if you can call it that, he tells her that she needs to experience the world for herself, to see things beyond the forest. So when he no longer needs her to pose as his fiancée, he will set her free, to see the world, as it were. My guy, she was dragged all over Europe by her father in attempts to con people out of their money. I don't think we can describe her as naive. And after he tells her this, he then very publicly proposes to her with a deep kiss. Poor Agnes. She has spent the last 8 years in service to Lazarus, protecting him, admiring him, loving him in her own way. Now she is being used as an ornament, and when he is done with her, apparently he doesn't need her anymore, so he will send her away. And then he puts a rock on her finger. Talk about mixed signals. I don't know why he thought this was a good idea. Because it's not. And Agnes is seething. By the time they get back to their penthouse, Agnes has made up her mind to prove to Lazarus that he does need her, that her skills are not unremarkable. She attempts to strike him with the sword she had smuggled under her clothing, and instead of getting what could have been an amazing moment of skill and empowerment, truly proving herself, instead, we get to watch Lazarus knock her over instantly, insult the fact that she is a virgin, and overpower her. When she is sufficiently pulled down, he hikes up her skirt, pulls her underwear to the side, and puts his mouth between her legs. For me, this moment was pretty jarring. Back in episode 12, I said that forbidden temptation was domination curious, and clearly Lost King is following in its predecessor's footsteps. However, there wasn't anything sexy about this. Yeah, Agnes has resented the fact that Lazarus would never see her as a fully grown woman, that he's ready to cast her aside despite her feelings for him. But this is not a moment of seduction. This is not a moment of Lazarus allowing himself to open up to Agnes as a partner. To me, this feels like sexual assault. Agnes is being held down and forced to experience the touch of a man who only wants to use her as a tool. Although she has wanted his touch, resented the fact that she has needed him, she had no say in what just went down. She cried out and moved away from him, and he let her go. I consider that a lesson, he said, looking at her with eyes more feral and beast-like than anything she'd ever seen before. You do not have the control here. You are not more powerful than I. And if you do not learn to understand life, as I said, every facet, you will never be able to win. Agnes does try to regain some of her agency, accusing him of suffering from desire just like she had been, but he continually insults her, and she's finally had it. She tells him that since he was so keen on to release her, he no longer has any control over what she does or says from now on. She will only keep up the fiancé charade as she wants, and will walk away from him forever just like he wants. It's only as a favor to him that she's going to continue on with it. At least when we watched Tinley and Alexius interact, Tinley kept her dignity about her. She was secure enough with herself to know what choices she made, and had some agency when Alexius put his alpha male domination hat on. Agnes hasn't been able to make any choices for herself before this moment. Her entire experience has been at the beck of Colin Lazarus, and he spends every moment berating and insulting her. I can't stand it. I'm sure that this book has its fans. I know that there will be people who will defend this book no matter what I say. But this is the moment where any redemption is impossible for me. I don't care what Lazarus will do from here on out. It won't be enough to save his image. The next day, he yells at Agnes for sleeping in late, despite the fact that he never told her when to wake up. He is confused by her lack of respect, no more my lords, like he's ever deserved them in the first place. He tells her that they will be leaving for Leary in an hour, and as soon as they land, they will be going for an audience with Alexius. The trip back to Leary is as venom-soaked as you can imagine. Agnes is putting on a fine show, but she has made it very clear that she will do whatever she wants at this point. They arrive at the castle, Lazarus meets up with Alexius, and Agnes and Tinley are left to get to know one another. I really have to say, for some reason, the Alexius I met in this book is so not the Alex I met in the last one. They felt so different that they might as well feel be in different characters. Tinley didn't feel the same either, just to not that extreme. Agnes is put off, however, because, if we remember, Tinley had a cat, and for some reason Agnes is concerned. Like, she's confused that Tinley has a pet? I have no idea. They exchange stories and have a conversation about what else? Love. Oh yes, Agnes is so very much in love with Lazarus, and it's so nice that she can talk about it with Tinley now. Later on, she meets up with Lazarus again, and she feels guilt setting in. They were here to get information so that Lazarus could be better equipped to remove Alexius from the throne, but Alexius and Tinley were so nice, and this was just another con that her father taught her how to run. The more she sees of the palace and the people in it, the more sure she becomes that Lazarus is not on the right path. So if we remember from the last novel, there was this bonkers bathhouse where the royalty of Leary would traditionally use right before battle. So Lazarus is pretty much of the mind that he is technically at war, so he is going to use the bath. Oh, and he'll drag Agnes along with him, because of course he does. He thinks to himself, this is a challenge, that he is still a man that can keep Agnes in her proper place. Because of course he does. But he does have an incredible moment of clarity and self-awareness while he's verbally sparring with this poor woman that he's dragged along with him. But had anyone ever worked to gain her trust, really and truly? Had anyone ever done anything for her? It was clear now what she wanted. Agnes wanted to feel special. And as for himself, Lazarus knew nothing about feelings. What he knew was strength. What he knew was power, a sense of duty and honor, and a sense of ownership. He knew care because it was what one did when they had the responsibility to another person. Yes, he knew about those things. But he had to figure out just how to show those things to her, to find a way to reach her so that this time when he pleasured her, she was not hurt or upset. He had to try something new. Oh, did Einstein over here figure out that sexual assault and insults were not, in fact, the way to a lady's heart? Okay, so instead of giving her sex the way she thought she was going to get, he just leaves her in the bath. Agnes has no idea what he's doing. She can't figure him out, get any kind of read on what he's even doing with her right now. She thinks about her devotion to him over the years, describing how she literally slept at his feet in order to better protect him when they traveled. My heart is breaking for this girl. Lazarus, meanwhile, is figuring out that a nice dinner would be an excellent way to start a proper seduction. And he's thinking about the future, when he was the king of Leary, when he would need a wife, someone to bear his children. He's become self-aware enough to know that a regular woman wouldn't have any clue on how to deal with him. And here is Agnes, and she is basically training to do exactly that. She is the perfect choice. I think there is an actual sociological term for this. I don't know, but I am so exhausted that I can't remember exactly what it is. Over dinner, they actually talk to each other. Weirdly, about Agnes's life before Lazarus had rescued her. But you've known her for 8 years. She's been at your beck and call for 8 freaking years, and you've never bothered to ask where she's from. They also talk about the day Lazarus came to the forest, when the wolves had attacked him and Agamemnon had rescued him. Agamemnon didn't kill the wolves, though, of course, because they lived in harmony with the animals. The wolves never took anyone from the people of the trees or stole from the village, but the moment Dionysus wandered in the woods, they slaughtered him. How strange. Anyway, they talk a little bit more, and then he kisses Agnes. She is overwhelmed with desire, but when she says his name, he says that he is not doing his job well enough if she can speak, and he releases her. He tells her that it would be good for her to go away from him for a while, see the world, you know, but he wants her to come back. And when she does, he wants to marry her.
Talk about some mixed signals, huh?
After that, he runs off into the shower. She waits for him to come out, thinking over what he'd said, and decides to don some lacy lingerie and wait for him to come out. When he does, she pulls the "this is my choice" power move and basically launches herself at him. They make out, and she does go down on him, basically taking all of her stolen agency from this entire book and dumping it here. To the book's credit, the sex isn't bad. Just like I said for the first book, the author's strength is obviously in her sex scenes. It's not just in and out intercourse here. They make use of each other's bodies. He makes sure that she has an orgasm before he even enters her. And then I find little gems like this. And when it burst, it was all glitter, and there was nothing dark or insidious beneath. It was bright all the way down, the kind of glory that she'd only dreamed existed in this world. And when he shattered right along with her, it was like dying and being made new again. It's poetic, slightly over the top, but exactly what I would expect from this particular brand of Harlequin. In any other book, the scene would be a great addition to the prose. But it's not in any other book. It's in this book. After he comes back to himself, Lazarus finds himself thinking that was his goal all along to make a bedmate with Agnes instead of a warrior? Which, the implications are horrific, considering she was 16 when he found her. She started crying for some reason, and the dialogue here is clunky again, defaulting to that overly formal cadence that has been driving me crazy. The next morning, Agnes is invited to tea with Tinley, and she feels that guilt creeping up again. They basically repeat their "you totally love him" conversation, and Tinley asks if Agnes might be pregnant. Why? Because Agnes has a sweet tooth? Again, who knows? Meanwhile, Alexius and Lazarus are out for a ride. Lazarus talks about the wood and the people in it, and the real gripe that they have, that the land had been stolen from them. Alexius is remarkably understanding, and he wants to do right by everyone. He offers a truce to Lazarus, a way forward where they co-ruled over their lands. I think. I'm not really paying attention to the politics at this point. Lazarus is shocked at his brother's approach to the situation. He has been ready for war, but Alexius surprised him with a peaceful option. They head back to the palace, and Lazarus tells Agnes that they're heading back to the woods with the news. For the amount of time that they spent in lavish accommodations, I am shocked that they decide to hike their way to the village. Lazarus explains to Agnes what's going on, how surprised he was that Alexius didn't want to go to war, and his struggles to be a good leader to his people and to her. And then they have sex in the woods, like you do. Just like the scene before it, it's fine. Agnes confesses her love to him, and amazingly, he doesn't turn tail and run like I've seen so many of these so-called alpha men do. They make it back to the Forest Kingdom, and Lazarus tells everyone the news. And incredibly, the people don't all revolt on the spot after their years of waiting for supposed revenge. It's a good sign from the looks of it. There's another moment of how did the secret society pull this off when Lazarus and Agnes head to his castle, all black and glittering with gems and oh my god, could you get any more emo? They take a bath together and finally settle themselves in for the long haul. Lazarus will not be rid of Agnes if she has anything to say about it, and she is willing to wait while he sorts out his emotional constipation. Here is where I might insert a joke about how she could do so much better, or try to find ways to connect the text with the author's intent, but honestly, I am tired, and I'm pretty much over these two. Because the thing is, Lazarus knows he's messed up. He's come to realize that he is not behaving in healthy ways with the people around him. But he's more than happy to place the burden of, quote, fixing him right onto Agnes's shoulders. And she doesn't deserve that. He's put her through hell for who knows how long, and as a reward, she gets to deal with his emotional damage. Fantastic prize. How generous of him. Of course, the text doesn't frame it like this. It's framed in that romantic lens where she's willing to sacrifice so much for him, to do whatever it takes to make him happy one day. How selfless she is, how devoted she is. But after watching Lazarus treat her like a naive child for nearly the entire story, all I feel is sad for her. She has been gaslit into thinking that this is the best she is going to get, that all of this time, Lazarus has been waiting for her. Back at the other palace, Tinley and Agnes have yet again another talk about the men in their lives, like it's the only thing that they can think of. All the conversation really does is reinforce my opinion that Agnes is prepared to sit out the storm that is Lazarus and emotions, and how I think she should run. Lazarus has arranged for a dinner for himself and Agnes, intending to propose properly to her that night, but for some reason, he has decided to hold their dinner on a balcony right next to the place where Lazarus had been taken by the wolves. It's got him on edge or something, and then something Agnes says gets his wheels turning. How strange it is that they never see the wolves. How strange indeed. A memory comes back to him. A man's face in the forest as he chased the ball that he'd been playing with. And it clicks for him. He had been lured by Agamemnon into the forest, told that he nearly lost his life to the wolves, and now he was in the old man's debt forever. That those dogs of his were really the wolves that had ravaged him. Wow. I'm stunned. He realizes that the same servitude he had been forced into was exactly the same as the one Agnes had been forced into. Are you just now figuring out that you might have taken advantage of the 16-year-old girl you ran into? Is that just now crossing your mind? And amazingly, he thinks to himself, I can't possibly propose to her now. It's a terrible idea to force her again. I am seriously done at this point. This might be one of the most forced third act separations we have seen yet. It is convoluted and stupid, in my humble opinion. He pushes her away, of course, and even after everything, and she heads off to Paris to do whatever she wants. She doesn't argue too much, and then Lazarus sulks around his brother's palace for a week. Tinley tells him to stop being stupid, go after her, she loves you, you dum-dum. And Alexius tells him, I've got a private jet. Go get her, you dum-dum. So he does, and he finds her at a little apartment in Paris, and he promises to love her forever, to devote himself to her, and she accepts him back into her life. The end. Cool. Glad we're done with that, because if you can't tell, I did not like that. At all. There was probably a lot more that I really missed, but I missed it because I was too busy fighting white-hot rage any time Lazarus opened his mouth. There's only so much alpha maleness that I can take, and Lazarus used up all of my patience and then some. But to really get into it, let's just cut into the chase and start with Heather's final score. Our cover starts us off with an astounding 1 out of 5. There is just so much about this cover that I hate, and yet it still manages to be boring. The bad Photoshop, the poorly posed couple, the background of a generic castle with tacked-on highlights on the hill, it's just a mess. And not even the magical airbrushing that usually accompanies the Harlequin Presents series can save it. I don't even know what to do with drama right now, because I was so busy being angry at the lead that it didn't leave a lot of room for me to take in the story itself. Lazarus made a big deal about possibly going to war with his brother, and Agnes was feeling guilty for lying to Tinley and Alexius. Maybe in another book, these points might actually measure up for something, but here they were just background radiation for the tension between our couple. So, failing to catch my attention, drama has earned itself a 2 out of 5. Romance is a flat 1 out of 5. Shocker, I know. But in all actuality, I hated the chemistry our leads had with each other. If it wasn't Lazarus treating Agnes like he owned her, or insulting her, or in general tripping over himself so she would feel bad for him, it was Agnes pining over the fact that she literally would die to save his life. I have no idea how he never realized that the situation he put Agnes in would result in her falling in love with him. I cannot stress enough how gross it was that he looked at his 16-year-old girl, lost, about to die on the streets of Paris, and thought to himself, yeah, this will go fine when I turn her into my indentured servant. Because that's what it is. Lazarus became Agamemnon's indentured servant when the old bastard saved Lazarus, and he turned around and did the same thing to Agnes. And when he had the revelation that perhaps he wasn't making a warrior, but an eventual sexual partner, no, 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 no. There was no romance here, just angst and emotional damage. Spice level is a little tricky. The sex wasn't badly written, but that mostly includes the moments when Agnes was a willing participant. The moment when Lazarus held her down for oral sex does not do the story any favors. Yes, the blurred lines of consensual non-consent is a highly enjoyable aspect of many romance novels, but like I always say, context matters. Lazarus had pissed Agnes off enough that she felt as though she had to physically attack him to get to see her point. And then in some twisted exercise of I told you so, he gets to prove that he was right all along by forcing her down and initiating unwanted sexual contact. Otherwise, the sex was fine, because at least Agnes was agreeing to it. But when we look at the romance score to remind us that she had essentially been groomed to be the perfect partner for Lazarus, it brings the whole story down. Ah yes, groomed, that was the term I was thinking of. Spice level will be a 2 out of 5. Now, for realism. I made a promise to myself that I would never put a 0 on any of these scores, but I am sorely tempted here. Nothing about this story is real in any way, shape, or form. Nothing felt like it could happen to anyone. There is no way a lost prince would just happen upon a girl about to die in the streets and rescue her. There is no way an actual prince could get lost inside the woods and the entire kingdom wouldn't kill themselves over finding any actual evidence that he was dead. They would have torn those woods apart in today's modern world of search and rescue. The score might be somewhat salvageable if the dialogue had not been an absolute trash fire. Everything felt clunky, inauthentic, and nothing meshed together. If the author wants to write about a fictional kingdom with a historical flavor, then she could do that. If she wanted to write about the creature comforts of wealth and royalty, then she could do that. But when she tried to bring the two together, it did not blend well, and frankly, brought me out of the story every chance it got. I really could go on about this, but I'll refrain. Realism will get a 1 out of 5. This book is just a giant mess. Its predecessor amused me enough that I could look away from its flaws and enjoy the spectacle. This book, however, found all of those flaws and turned them up to 11, eventually to the point where it was all that I could see. In some ways, it felt like a bot wrote this book. There were strange moments of grammar that I wasn't sure made sense, and no one spoke like an actual human person. Agnes was dripping with cliches as Lazarus kept finding weapons on her, and Lazarus was a garbage human. And when I was finished reading this book, I came up with a theory. Maisie Yates has written over 100 books for Harlequin. Good for her. I don't fault the achievement. But I get the feeling that her first few dozen sold so spectacularly that at some point she could coast on author notoriety alone, and Harlequin just cuts her a check for every manuscript that she sends them without even reading them. I realize that this is a harsh criticism, but it is my genuine opinion. This book isn't constructed well. There might be a compelling story in these pages, but right now, it is buried under piles of nonsense and bad setups. So for my final score, A Bride for the Lost King makes its way to the shelf of shame with one abusive prince out of 5. Thank you for joining me, readers and romance seekers, and I hope to see you once again for Hopelessly Romantic. If you like the show, please visit us at hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. If you have questions or want to recommend a read, please email us at contact@hopelesslyromanticpodcast.com. The show is written and produced by me, Heather Songster. Our technical advisor is Kwang Yin Cho. Hopelessly Romantic is an HK production, and it doesn't really matter what you read, only that it's what you love.